What's up, founders, and welcome to the In Demand podcast, where we talk all about how to troubleshoot growth for your PLG SaaS. I'm your co-host, Asia Arangio, the CEO and founder of Demand Maven.
And I'm Kim Talarczyk, client services manager at Demand Maven, where we help SaaS companies reach their toughest growth milestones.
All right, Kim, let's get into it. Okay, so I wanted to zag a little bit instead of our typical zig, and I figured it would be fun if we covered a bunch of topics in one, or I say a bunch, if we covered 2 to 3 topics in one episode and kind of cram it in, because a lot of these are things that are important and they're good to talk about and to break down for folks. But I'm also kind of like, do I really want to spend 45 minutes talking about this one thing? Maybe not. And maybe that's not as interesting for listeners either.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah. So I figured, okay, there are 3 things that we were brainstorming just now of what to break down. And the first one, I actually would love it if you explained a little bit, but it's related to when we run customer research, so specifically jobs to be done. And the face that I have during the interview process versus the face that everyone else has. And like wheels are turning in a way for me that don't turn for everyone. And I just love to have you start there and kind of explain that further, because I don't think I explained it well, but.
Yeah. So yeah, for people listening, we just got done a week customer interview sprint. Mm-hmm. So we talked to so far, 9 customers or 8 or 9? Mm-hmm. We'll be talking to more next week. I find and the client joins these calls as well. Demand Maven team members join, obviously, and are running these calls. And it's always fascinating to me watching you, Asia, during a sprint like this, because, you know, I'm listening to the customer too, and I see the wheels turning in your head, and you will have these epiphanies. And these are customers, the clients with the call, they're talking to their customers actually a lot. This particular client actually has an engaged community of users, which is great.
Very
so
engaged.
They do hear from them, and your wheels are turning in a way that you are on the fly, and as this is happening, are having these epiphanies, and you're kind of making these, here's a gap, and you are coming up with ways and offering ways for the client to take action on things like very quickly. And I just what is happening in your head? It's just, and also too, just, and for people that aren't familiar with this type of work, when we do this work, we pack it all in, but then we do generate insights from it. And that takes a little bit of time. And we look for themes, of course. And there's ways that we are packaging up and then sharing this across the business to use.
Yeah.
But you also are able to help the team take action stuff. So yeah, I just share what's happening in your brain during a week like this.
And why my face is always, yes. Or I'm not even, that's what I'm imagining I'm doing. And when I'm running the call, it's very different than when I'm not. And I'm just like listening in.
Actually, in what way? What do you mean?
So I find like when I'm actually running the interview myself, I actually also feel like it hits different than when I'm listening in. And I think that's just from the nature of like when I'm an active participant versus when I'm still an active participant, but I'm like, I'm not actually running the call, but I am listening still.
You have to run the call and make sure that you're guiding the conversation a certain way, as opposed to when you're the one that's listening in, your wheels are kind of turning in a different way.
Definitely. Okay, so part of this is when you can. So one of my scary superpowers is, while I might not remember every detail about a customer interview, there are certain things that I do remember as patterns of behavior. And usually across some volume of interviews, there are very clear patterns that emerge in terms of behavior. So for example, a few of the opportunities that I was hearing in this latest batch of research had to do with not just what the customer was doing, but also in a way of what they weren't doing. So for example, it's actually very common to hear, like in really competitive markets, that a customer is looking up and trying out like 6 to 10 solutions. We've heard that before. So this is very common in productivity software, where if someone's looking for a project management solution, they will literally sign up and try 8 to 10 different things.
Yep.
You get in some markets, though, where it's 2 to 3, and you better be in that 2 to 3. And maybe others are kind of in consideration, but not really. Like, realistically speaking, there's really only enough time and bandwidth to try 2 to 3 solutions. And there also was a clear pattern in what the context of that person, of that customer or prospect had before they actually got into our solution. Meaning if they came from, you know, one of the big 800-pound gorilla solutions, they would look at us like, oh, this is awesome. It's great value. Like they had really good positive feelings about it because they're coming from something that is not serving them as well as it could or should. But if they came from something else, like something fringe, like they weren't coming from nothing, but they were coming from something, but it wasn't like a clear winning solution like in the space. They came from something kind of low-key random. They actually would look at our solution, okay, I mean, it's nice. It's helping us in some ways, but it's not in others. And what I gleaned from that was, oh, we might not do a good job of making it clear why you would choose us over something that's like kind of close, but not ideal. Mm. And but it wasn't something that the customer didn't say, you didn't have any copy or messaging on your site that made me feel like, you know, this was going to be a good deal based off of what I was coming from. They didn't literally say that. Right. But the pattern that I was seeing was, oh, this bucket of customers, when they come from this solution, they seem to have this impression. But this bucket of customers, if they come from this type of solution, not even like this specific thing, but just if they come from something that wasn't designed for them, but was cheap and they made it work, they're getting good value by using our product, but they're almost like more critical of it in a way that they might not have been if they were coming from the 800-pound gorilla solution. And so it made me realize, oh, you know, we spend all of our time competing against these guys, but there are people coming in that are comparing us against these guys, and they are not nearly the solution that we are. But we don't have messaging that speaks to them. You know what I mean? So the wheel that's turning for me is literally every new thing that I'm hearing, I'm cross-referencing against every other single interview that we've done, whether it's 4, 5, or 10, or 15. If we're on interview number 15, I'm checking the box of, is this new or have I heard this? And whether I've heard it before or if it's new, it either builds the algorithm in my head for, oh, this is the pattern that's producing this output or this outcome, or it's breaking it. And I'm like, why is it breaking it? That's interesting. That's not to say either that old stuff is boring and new stuff is what you should pay attention to, but it's really more like the repeat stuff is the pattern. And patterns are interesting too, because they highlight what the gaps are, in my opinion.
Yeah. So if you're now seeing a pattern, would you advise the client to start taking action on that? Or is it like the next step is, let's actually see if this pattern holds true? Should we talk to more people? Should we dig into it more? What does that look like?
I think it's more, what outcome does this pattern create? What behavior is this creating now? There's a pattern that's happening. What is now the typical behavior that 9 times out of 10 will happen? And of course, there are always outliers. That's what breaks the pattern. And then, are we cool with that? Is that a desirable thing? And then patterns stack on top of other patterns. So it's not just one behavior that creates a sale or a buy or a sign up. It's usually several. And so then I'm thinking, okay, how do all these things stack together? And what's maybe less ideal and what's more ideal? And what's unknown? Because there's also things that we don't know everything about the customer journey. We try to get as close as we possibly can, but we don't know everything. So then it's kind of like there are certain things that we don't know that are positively impacting. And it's just based off of what the customer can remember. And also, too, sometimes the customer doesn't and they lie, as Bob Moesta likes to remind us. And they're not lying because they're being malicious. They don't even know they're lying. Like they don't even know. So you can trust certain things to an extent. But I'm not judging the pattern immediately. I really only draw conclusions after we get further in the research process. Once we get to like interview 6 7, 8, 9, that's when I start to really get a really good sense of, oh, these are the patterns that are supportive and these are the patterns that are detractive. So the comparison, for example, the competitive analysis and the comparison that's happening for one batch of customers versus another, one we're serving well, but another we're not. And I think that's creating an anti-pattern. Like, it's creating something that's negative. It's taking away from us, actually. And the only way to, we can't tell customers, don't compare us to those people. The best we can do is meet them halfway and to make it easier for them to make us an obvious choice. So to me, that's on us. Like, we need to do a better job of speaking to that. And then there's other things too. So speaking of patterns, I love listening for patterns across value themes. So you're going to hear customers talk about, oh, it's so easy to use. It's so intuitive. And those are the words that they may like directly say. But I like to listen for things that they don't directly say. It's more implied. So they will, it's so funny because like you could ask this question to a customer. You'll be like, what's the thing that you love the most about XYZ product? And I'm like, I mean, you know, it does this. And then they'll spend a whole other 10 minutes talking about this thing that they really like about the product, but they won't actually say, I love that thing. But they'll spend literally 10 minutes talking about it. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the website builder, it's been really cool because, you know, I can do XYZ or whatever. And they'll spend forever talking about that thing. But when you ask the question, so what do you love about the product? They won't mention that thing because they'll make up something else entirely. But it's, I literally just listened to you for 10 minutes talk about how much you love that thing. That's probably a value theme that you might not be aware of consciously, but subconsciously, you care about this. And yeah. So that tells me, especially if I start hearing patterns across value themes, I start thinking, are we doing a good enough job speaking to that value? And then sometimes I'll hear value themes. And there's certainly patterns across some subset of interviews. Maybe 3 out of 10 people said this thing. And it'll be like, you know, it helps me look really polished, or it'll be something very obscure, but is very real. And then I start thinking, do we tell that story on the site at all? Or do we tell that story, ever in any of our messaging? And I start wondering, oh, this is a pattern creating, it's a desired behavior. Like, it's supporting us. But I don't think maybe we're doing the best job of meeting them halfway in that moment. And so I'm kind of thinking like, we described it as gaps, but there's always a gap between what someone is desiring and hoping for and thinking and wishing and dreaming. And then there's us. And are we putting that out there?
And so we're talking to customers that are already using the product. And it sounds like, so now the goal, one of the goals might be, okay, now how do we attract more customers mm-hmm. that are good customers? What's an example of a value theme? Because that's what you mean, right? So now this customer has come in and they don't even really know the value theme, but you kind of draw it out and you're hearing it by the way they're talking. Maybe that this person didn't actually come in because of this value theme. Maybe it's just, oh, right, now this is actually great because I can use this tool for this and it makes me look good. So I'm going to say this back. You tell me this is where you're going with this. So then we're now taking that and saying, maybe we're actually not doing a good job saying to everyone else that they could also have that. We're going to update our messaging so people can say, oh yeah, you can look good like that too. Is that what you're meaning? Is this how this value theme is playing out?
And usually, again, across a set of interviews, you're going to pick out several value themes, and maybe about half of them or two-thirds of them, you're doing a good job or a decent job making sure you're speaking to that. And there's probably like a good half or third that you're not at all, but you could be. And mm-hmm. So I'm listening for that. Those are messaging opportunities to me. They're also not just messaging, but also like brand opportunities usually. And it makes me think, oh, are we doing a good enough job also with making sure we appear maybe how we should to this audience? And then there's also tactical stuff too that comes up. So of course, like when you unpack the customer journey, you'll hear channels usually. And there were a few that popped up that we kind of have our toe in, but we haven't really committed. We've heard it enough times though that like YouTube, for example, came up, I think three or four times. And we kind of have our toe in there. Like, we have a YouTube channel, but we're really we haven't really committed. And I think what's holding us back is we just don't have a clear process, or we don't have a clear work path for making that real for us. And which is a fancy way of saying there's no process or operations behind it right now.
Yeah. Or
strategy,
or
even
to know how to meet the customer where they're at when they are on YouTube.
And YouTube is such an algorithm game and requires a certain type of investment. It doesn't have to be big investment. It could be scrappy, but we just haven't really committed mental energy or resources to really figure that out. But this has motivated me and the team to figure it out, because we've heard it. I think literally half of the interviews have mentioned YouTube in some kind of way.
So are you, what does this look like as your wheels are turning, these things are popping up? How are you now gathering these insights and starting to relay it to the team? And of course, some things, like you said, they don't become a pattern, or what does that look like?
Yeah, it is documentation to start, and then prioritization. And then I'm a big fan of understanding the trade-offs. For example, there are some clear opportunities that we can leverage from this research, from the insights that we've gathered. Now I have to do the brain work of, okay, based on what's on deck for Q2 and Q3, what can we fit in? What do we think will have the highest return and the highest impact? So this kind of goes into prioritization. So we've talked about prioritization frameworks before. So my thinking too is like, with the resources that we have on deck, what makes sense to tackle based on what we've learned? And I mean, and that's just management, really. It's management, it's strategy, it's planning, all the things, and just decision-making. So that's really the next step. The cool part, though, is that we did this research work. I am also a fractional CMO, so I actually have the ability to make the decision. But if I wasn't fractional CMO, I would either be working with the CEO or the founder on this, or I'd be working with the head of marketing or VP of marketing or whoever's in charge. And it's a negotiation practice. You have to figure out what can you fit in, because these ideas or these insights do become actual tangible projects that have deadlines and tasks and activities. And now we have to divide and conquer. We don't have to do everything, but really we should be picking the things that are, okay, these are the highest impact, lowest lift. And then anything that's higher lift, higher impact, we just figure out, like, how do we prioritize this? Because we can see it. We just need to put our arms around it. But what I find is that sometimes it's process that holds people back, and sometimes it's capacity. But I actually feel like capacity is relatively easy if you have budget. If you don't have budget, different story. But if you have budget, you can solve a capacity problem. Now it's just prioritization. But if you have capacity, but it's process that's getting in the way, that process is actually the easiest thing to solve, especially now with AI. And I actually feel like it's a little too easy to execute sometimes. But that's just my perspective. I realize that a lot of people don't feel that way.
Yeah, and I think sometimes you have to pick something and just ship it or just start.
Yes, I feel and this is a hot take, and I know this is different for everybody, but I do think, especially for technical founders, this is kind of where folks get stuck, because there might be a little bit of overthinking about the execution side. And actually, maybe we're a little better off if we underthink this a little bit, because what matters is actually just doing it. And there was a time where I would be like, strategy is way better than execution. But I've come around a lot on this. I do think strategy is certainly important, but I think execution is equally important. And if you can't execute because you're in the way, there's a problem. Or because you're literally overthinking it. Like, we don't need to overthink execution. That's actually the part that's the easiest, in my opinion. So operations and process and creating work paths to execute shouldn't be the problem. It's actually too easy to execute these days. I mean, most people start the YouTube channels literally with their iPhones, and they just hit record and upload. It really shouldn't be hard. Now, if we want to do something of quality, maybe a little bit more time and investment. But really, the part that should be the most stressful actually should be the prioritization part of, when do we do this? And what scope should we have when we do it? And when we do it, why are we doing it? So that, to me, is the hardest part. But
and
not
what
the,
are the outcomes we want from it.
How are we going to measure this? Like, how are we going to actually report on the success of this program or whatever it is that we're doing? That, and then deciding, like, when does my team do it versus not? When do we tackle this? Do we have bandwidth? And again, capacity to me is pretty easy to solve, especially today. But that should be the hard part. It shouldn't be the actual execution, in my opinion.
Yeah. And that kind of leads a little bit to something else we wanted to touch on today.
Yeah.
Is it going back to this client as well that we've been just recently been doing a lot of work for and your fractional CMO. From my view, it seems like you are doing all the things. I mean, there's a lot that's being executed. There's strategy. There's, I guess, in some ways, it seems almost like a little bit chaotic, but not chaos. There seems to be like a balance of structure and chaos, but like things are happening. So I guess, like, how are you doing all the things? How do you balance, like you said, actually executing, but then also making sure you're laying out the strategy?
Yeah. It's so interesting because you said this earlier and I just laughed because I was like, it's not how I feel.
How do you feel?
I think I feel more, I was telling this to my business coach the other day and I was like, I feel like in some ways we're making a lot of progress. The progress on the things that are the most important feel very slow. So like SEO has taken forever to forever to me is a month, by the way. So I'm just going to put that out there. I'm impatient as hell. I've always been. And I'm seeing that so clearly for myself now that I'm in this fractional CMO role. I'm like, damn, I am so impatient. Like, I think things should just happen in like a week. But it's because when you run your own business, you low-key kind of can just make things happen in a week. And that's the time horizon that I'm used to. I will say I'm very patient in terms of performance. Like, I know it takes people time to deliver results. I've never been one to have completely unrealistic expectations in that way. But when I think about, God, it literally took us like a month and a half to research, find, and commit and hire an SEO person. And I don't know why, but it eats at me because I'm like, that's like a month and a half of runway that I don't have anymore. And I don't know, I'm just impatient as hell in that way, but not in the, okay, now we have someone, it's going to take them time. Understandable. I'll push where if I really feel like I need to push, but I don't. So in some ways I feel like some certain things have taken forever and I'm like, it's May and I feel good, but I'm also like, Q2 is going to be stressful and I got to figure out how we're going to steer the ship in the right direction. Because we're kind of at the whim a little bit of all of our previous programs and efforts from quarters past and also seasonality. So things are going to dip in the summer. And I'm just like, I'm bracing myself because I'm such an achiever and a performer that like sometimes it's hard for me to stomach seasonality a little bit. But anyway, I digress.
But it does seem like so those bigger things at play, like SEO, and that does take time, not only to get someone on board, but then, of course, to see changes actually happening once that SEO work is being done. But there's little things that are slowly moving the needle, and operationally things that are happening. I mean, I do see you creating a lot of artifacts, for example.
Yeah, lots of artifacts, lots of briefs. Yeah, I would say like my style of management is, and also leadership is very much, I don't believe that anyone should be guessing about where something is or what their role is in the thing I'm not a big fan either of siloing and partitioning off myself so that I'm having like all these like one-to-one conversations with everyone about the same project that everyone is working on. That should just be in the main channel. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's my style. You know, I know some people are very sensitive about cluttering up channels. Like the team is very remote. No one's working in an office. But when I think about how I approach operationalizing a function, it's, again, is there a clear work path to execute this? In the product marketing case, so Kim is also referring to, we've got a launch coming up for a very large feature set that we're bringing to the platform. And it probably seemed like overnight we had a plan, which in a way we kind of did. I think the CEO started on this. We had a board meeting, though, and so he got kind of busy, which is understandable because board meetings, I know, can be intense. And a couple of other things happened, too. And then basically I was like, let me just take this because I can literally create a brief overnight. And that's exactly what happened. And then to me, it's okay, this is the plan. This is what we're going to do. Executors now need to execute. That's been my motto the last couple of weeks. I need to get executors executing. And as the executive, if I can't get my team to execute, we have a huge problem. There's a huge problem. And so I'm thinking, what are the blockers to execution? People probably don't know what's happening. They probably don't know what they need to do. And they probably don't know when they need to do it. Now, generally speaking, and I don't know if every manager or executive is necessarily like this. In this particular sense, our team is centralized, but we have some contractors and some full-time. And there's differing skills, expertise, et cetera, levels too, and also capacity. And so in the role that I'm in, I have to make it really clear to my contractors, for example, all right, here's what's going to happen. You already know how to do this. I'm not going to tell you how to write the copy, but you take this email and you take that email and you take the social post. And my job is now done unless there's something that I'm missing or there's a gap that like strategically that we're missing. So for example, we were going to write an email to a specific audience and now we're not. And so me, VP of product, CEO, we're all deciding together. And this is all happening in Slack, by the way, which can get messy. But in this particular case, because it's focused, it really wasn't. It actually was pretty clean.
Yeah. And that brief you're talking about, it's beefy, which is amazing. And it also has in it like what the messaging
strategy is.
The messaging strategy, right? So you said like the content people know how to write content. That doesn't need to be micromanaged. But that messaging strategy is there based on what this feature is. And then also, you know, the product got involved to write more about the feature so that everyone in marketing also understands. And then, of course, it's a living, breathing document. So if anything changes, product can jump in if needed and make edits or, you know, whoever can make those edits.
Yeah.
Which, to your point, that's right. That's what's helping you now run the strategy and the execution to happen.
Yeah. And so now management is actually very easy for me now that we have this brief. And it's not, it probably still feels a little chaotic because we're kind of building this on the fly together, but it's also relatively organized. Like I don't feel like my team has had too many questions. And that to me is a marker of success, of at least for now. I could see a scenario where I actually do want more questions because it shows me that, you know, people are thinking about it. But at least in terms of, okay, what are we executing and what do I need to know to execute this well? And that to me is a marker of a job well done. Now but I think this also kind of speaks a little bit too, and this maybe is where it does feel a little chaotic. One of the things that I still need to do for the team is really help define roles and also make it and really unpack and understand how is the team spending time, not to micromanage, but to reprioritize or to redirect, because we might be spending too much time and energy in some areas and not enough in others. And those original areas may not be as high ROI, and which is one of the things that I'm like unpacking now. So I'm like, we might need to restructure a little bit. Not like restructure, give people new titles or roles, but more refocus. Mm-hmm. We might need to refocus people. And that is something that is coming. And I can feel that tension. And I think that's going to be my next big thing that I really focus on. But in terms of, yeah, like it probably does feel like I'm everywhere all at once. But it really is just because I am seeing what are actually the most high impact fires that can cause the most damage. And I'm wrapping my arms around them very quickly as I can. At first it was paid acquisition, then it was SEO. Now it's team structure and team roles and like team focus. And I would even say like in the beginning, it was budget and meeting cadence. Like even just the meetings that we were having was there a marketing meeting before? I don't think there was. I think it was just one-to-ones.
No, just one-to-ones.
It was just one-to-ones. That's right. Yeah, the CEO had one-to-ones with each individual marketer. And I was like, marketing meeting. Weekly marketing meeting, because the siloed conversations, it was causing the CEO to do double time, basically. Like he was basically having to have the same conversation over and over again. And then answer more questions in Slack. And I was like, oh, we can address that very quickly. So all that to say, as things pop up, I'm wrapping my arms around them. The product marketing is actually what came up And that probably is why it feels like I'm everywhere all at once.
Yeah. And we did a past episode on what, like, a fractional CMO and what that looks like and the differences mm-hmm. and or what to expect from a fractional CMO in general's work, which is kind of cool because now we're sort of getting into the weeds of what some of that looks like. Of course, it's not all going to be perfectly structured. There has to be movement and execution. It's a job of the CMO to wrap their arms around it. And starting with budget and some of those operational things makes sense because you sort of have to tweak those in order to now move on to what feels more chaotic because people are moving. People are actually shipping things.
Yeah, I think a lot about it's kind of like being a conductor in an orchestra. A conductor doesn't have to manage. It's really more about, like, how do they lead? And their orchestra is a team of experienced musicians. Mm. But the conductor is the only one who knows what is the sound that we need to play when we play. And that is what I feel like I'm trying to do. I don't know if I'm doing it well. We'll see.
Yes.
But what I'm trying to do is I'm like, you know, we really aren't hearing the violins enough. We got to get the violins a little bit louder. And, like, the cellos are a little off. They're a little, we got to slow them down. Like, it's actually lentamente. It's not, you know, it's not allegro or whatever the word is for being aggressive. And I kind of feel like that's how I'm approaching it. And then the brass players come in and it's like, whoa, too much. And let's calm that down. So that I feel like I'm reacting in real time. And to be honest, it's not actually my favorite way of leading. I like to be a little bit more proactive. I like to get ahead of things and kind of see the train coming, like, before it actually gets to the station. And I'm not there yet, but I feel as we smooth out some of these kinks, we'll get there. But mm-hmm. that's my perspective.
Yeah. We did want to talk about being a good manager versus being a good leader.
The segue is perfectly. Yeah, totally.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I remember I put this on the list probably like a month ago now. No, this was like last week. Was this like literally this week that I put this on the list?
I can't remember, maybe.
Probably. Okay, so this is a topic that I'm very passionate about. And I think it's because I have experienced both, like, great managers and great leaders. And I have also experienced, like, not great managers and not great leaders. Mm-hmm. And I know you have a lot of experience in this too. So I love also, like, your take on this. But to me, there is a very big difference between being a good manager versus being a good leader. And I think if you are in any executive or leadership position, you probably are going to have to do some mixture of both. And you're probably also going to have to do both at different times and at different degrees. There are some VPs, for example, and some chiefs who are excellent leaders, like, incredible. Not necessarily great managers, but the implication is that they have hired people who don't really need management. They kind of already know what to do and they just got to go and do the thing. But I also think, too, there are different definitions of this. To me, a leader is someone who really says, this is what the world should look like. Follow me along to go and make this world a reality. I think tangible examples of that is, I hate to use myself in this, I have this vision of what marketing should look like at this company. I now have to share that vision with my team and encourage them to come along with me and not dig their heels down because it's scary or it's uncomfortable or they don't actually believe in that vision. And it's interesting because I'm feeling that tension a little bit now where we lost our head of marketing. And for context, I joined in February, mid to end of February, mid-March, our head of marketing had to take a personal leave of absence. And then mid-April, Q2, they had to formally exit. So they're no longer at the company as of April. And that has left a huge gap in terms of execution. And also just like having someone on deck who also is extremely knowledgeable about the product and about the customers, et cetera. But that has created a certain type of stress because I think the team was used to a certain vision for marketing. I'm trying to paint them something else that is a little bit that's a little different than maybe what they've originally like were bought into at first. And there's a tiny bit of tension, but not in the like they don't believe in this vision. It's more like they don't know how we're going to get there. And so I need to do a better job of explaining to them, here's how we're going to get there. Here's what this is going to look like. But we were deep in research this week. I haven't been able to wrap my arms around this quite yet. But that is something that's like my biggest mission is I've got to make sure that I get buy-in on this vision for what the marketing team will look like. So that way things just happen smoother. The people who are on the ground executing are bought into this and they'll actually move forward and do it. Management, though, to me is very different. Management is more like you could be a great manager and a terrible leader. And I think it's not to say that managers lack vision, but it's more they're far more concerned with the output and the outcome. And I think they're far more concerned with individual performance than they are, or even like team or collective performance towards some tangible, like material goal. Usually it's like revenue production or lead production or whatever. And I find that this is also very common where you can be a manager of a super experienced team. Usually that experienced team is a team of individual contributors of some kind. And your job as manager is to ensure that this is effective, efficient, and is operationally sound, and like you're actually like achieving the goal. But again, you can be a manager and a leader at the same time. So you may still need to sell a vision, especially if you're a manager of a function that is new or is untested, or like maybe you're building the next electric vehicle and you've got to sell this team on building this thing. Like I think there's a lot of overlap. And at the same time, you can be an excellent leader and not a great manager. And I think in scenarios like that, you'll get someone who is, this is the vision for where we're going, but I can't tell you how we're going to get there. Or I can't make it really clear and tactical and tangible what you need to do to contribute to that. And I'm not going to keep up with you either. I'm not going to necessarily make sure that you're actually doing it.
Right. I'm going to be off coming up with new innovations. Right. New visions.
Right. I've experienced all of those. I've experienced good managers who were terrible leaders. I've experienced great leaders who were also great managers and vice versa. I've also had great leaders who were not great managers, but in a way that actually worked for me in some scenarios because I didn't necessarily need a ton of management, but having a little bit of guidance would have been nice.
Yeah. So are you saying in your current example you're giving, is that leadership combined with management?
For me?
Yeah, like the first example you gave. So you said you need to create this vision of what marketing looks like.
Yes.
And show them how to get there.
Yeah. Or even, I mean, and I may not have the specifics of how we'll get there, but in that, you know, this person needs to go and execute X next week. But I can say these are our areas of opportunity, and I can give a general sense of, yeah, like here's where I can sense where we go next. But yeah, I haven't done the best job of kind of clearly defining, here's the marketing function that I want to build. And we already have everyone on deck to do it. We just may need to refocus a little bit. I haven't done the best job of that. And when I joined, I created two artifacts. The first was the CMO's mandate. And that was my leadership vision, like on paper. And the second was marketing strategy. And that's more, I wouldn't say it's management, but it's definitely like executive level strategy setting for this function. And now I have to manage to this, or this is what I will now manage to and really lead the team towards in the short term. And yeah, and I think in terms of refocusing the team a little bit, making them feel assured that we can achieve what we're setting out to achieve, and also to not be afraid of a little bit of the chaos that's going to happen. Because on the one hand, they're probably going to get more structure than they felt before, which some people love that. And I would say probably most people, actually. But at the same time, there are things that are going to be chaotic, but that's okay. But the moment it becomes an issue, we got to resolve it, because too much chaos and people get stressed. But just enough chaos and it's okay. This is an opportunity. Now, it's just like conflict resolution. Like conflict is actually an opportunity. So how do we figure out how to overcome this or figure this out? And to not be afraid of voicing and communicating, hey, this is chaotic. We should solve this. And I think maybe the team doesn't feel like that right now, but they should, because I'm not a mind reader. I will ask questions, but I do expect, yeah, this sucks, or I expect honesty.
Right. And that goes back to the leadership, right? Like,
yeah.
So that's sort of setting sets the stage for what communication can happen and how, and transparency being part of the culture. Those are leadership qualities.
I'm so curious, because I see your notes here, but how do you define this?
Yeah, I mean, manager to me feels there has to be some sort of operations involved in it. Like, you know, even though managers might not also be individual contributors, like you had said, they're focused on output. Things need to happen. And of course, based on the size of the company, it's going to, you know, a founder and a CEO of a small company is going to have to be a leader and a manager in the beginning. But yeah, I see management of it really getting into more of the weeds of that day-to-day work. And I think good managers figure out how to not micromanage and how to, in a way, it's a little bit of leadership, but it's a little bit more tactical. It's, okay, how can I encourage and get the best output out of these resources? And then how do we also, you know, obviously like project management and resource allocation and all that, those are people that are good at those things, I find tend to be good managers. And to me, the leadership side doesn't necessarily have to have all of those. They don't have to have as much of the operational, although, like I said, a lot of times you need to do both. But I think the leader sort of sets the direction and kind of knows, you know, sets the stage, so to speak, gives the general direction. And a lot of even the how to get there can be that manager. Yeah.
It's a tricky one, because unless you like know the inner workings of a company, it's so funny, because I think even people actually disagree with this, but even now as people study him, but Steve Jobs comes a lot, I think. But it's interesting because Steve Jobs certainly is a leader. Whether or not he's a good one is debatable, because I think his leadership style could sometimes be very vitriolic, but he certainly is a visionary. And I think part of being a leader is tapping into some vision at some level. Whether or not he could get buy-in on getting people to do this in a way that was healthy for the company is a different story. And I think there were different seasons that he had, I think, where sometimes it was a mess and that maybe he was not the best leader in that, you know, kind of harsh. But it depends on how you define leader. But then I think there would certainly be times where without his leadership, certain inventions and innovations wouldn't have happened. So it's interesting, but not a manager, like, at all.
Yes. Yeah. And visionary is a good word, too, because I think a lot of times if you think visionaries, you know, you're thinking like Elon Musk, you're thinking of Steve Jobs. I think in those cases, too, the right people were with them to make sure everything went okay outside of them.
Yeah. Mark Zuckerberg, great example. Certainly a visionary. We don't know what kind of leader, really, but definitely not a manager. That's why he hired Sheryl Sandberg, COO. Yeah.
Yes.
So it's like, actually, there is someone that I think I'm thinking now about who are some great leaders that we know. And there is an easy list actually here. So off the top of my head, if I think about like certain bootstrap founders, I'm still really inspired by the story that Steve McLeod shared with us at Indie Founders. He talked about his business and about how he basically pivoted and was going down a path that wasn't going to, it's not that it wouldn't have been successful. It was just, they were, if I'm not mistaken, they were either stagnant or declining. And it took Steve's leadership to pivot the company and convince engineers and product managers and et cetera, like, this is the direction that we should go in. And it ended up being very profitable and lucrative for him. I'll have to find the name of his company and add it to the show notes, but it's not even a story I think is like super publicly out there. Although we're trying to get, I would love for him to share it in places because it's such a good story. Mm. And Josh Ho also, I think, is another, he has certainly, based on the stories that he's told about his founder journey, he certainly has displayed great leadership. And then easy ones like Peldy at Balsamic or Rand Fishkin at SparkToro. I mean, those are easy ones, of course, like great leaders. And we can see it. Like, we can see their leadership styles from the outside looking in. He's telling his stories at various conferences, Rand creating content and sharing what I feel like is his visionary work. And he wouldn't, so funny, because he wouldn't actually see it that way. But to everyone else, we're all like, wow, you're tapped into something divine over here, because not all of us are drawing these conclusions.
And I think all those examples have, they're good leaders because they know who needs to be with them to get, so fill in their gaps. The CTO that works with Rand, or at SparkToro, at least.
Yeah. Casey. Yeah.
Casey. Yeah. And right. So there's also something about being a good leader that you know what you need to fill in. If some leaders know that they're not going to be as good in the operations when they're first starting a business, or, you know, they have a co-founder that's leading that charge, or CTOs they bring in to make sure CFOs, right?
Totally. Totally. Yeah. And I think on the flip side, management, you really don't have to have a vision to be a good manager, because management is so much more about how is your team doing, really. And I will say, though, I think being a good manager, it's not all about output. I think it is also caring very deeply about who is on your team. Think about my mom, for example. She's been a bank manager pretty much her entire career. She just recently retired from the bank that she was with for 25 years, which It was First Credit Union, then Wachovia, and then Wells Fargo. And she has, as a manager, she has a team of diehard individuals, like, who have worked with her for decades and will follow her basically wherever she goes. And it's because, yes, as a manager, of course she has to care about, you know, the output of a team and tracking specific KPIs and goals. Like, of course, like, at a bank, like, you've got things that you have to report on. But she also was the one who would say, based on the circumstances of our location in our geographic region, our team is not going to be able to accomplish these goals. Here's why. And so she pushed back on several of these things. And also, I think what she really did very well was she fostered a sense of, she was an excellent team builder. And that improved the dynamic and performance of her bank. But it didn't come from obsessively caring about performance. It came from obsessively caring about the team, about each individual member, and having as much fun as possible, because you are at a bank and you deal with every type of customer on the planet. I could tell so many stories of just craziness that she has experienced as a bank manager for 20 something years, and still has managed to keep a very inspired, loyal, fiercely loyal team. I mean, she went from, where was it? She went from the Mall of Georgia Wells Fargo to, like, the Lawrenceville Wells Fargo. And her whole team was like, you're taking us with you. And it just was like they literally would follow her wherever she went. And she was able to cultivate this incredible dynamic. And I think the only way she could have was by being a great manager. And I think great managers maybe don't look exactly how you think they would. Like, there's almost like an impression of, oh, the manager is going to micromanage me, or it's going to be all about the goals, and, like, I'm just a cog in the wheel. But I also think being a good manager kind of means, like, you're very dialed into your team.
Yeah.
You really understand them and their needs. And that's something that I try to take with me, too, because I've seen how it has helped her. And she's got this fiercely loyal team now.
There's people skills there, building rapport. So, definitely not just operational or just project manager. And if really a project manager, a lot of times isn't actually managing people.
Right.
If you're getting hired in a bigger company and you're actually a project manager. Now, yes, in smaller companies, project management skills are going to be helpful as a manager. But that also makes me think of, like, a good, if we do a sports reference, like a good team captain.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think of a good manager like that. And there's a book, I'll have to look it up, something like Captain Class or something about, there's some relationship between business and captains people with strong. Anyways, if I can think of it, we'll throw in the show notes. But there's something there too. And a good captain you know, they're also leading by example. Yeah, they're guiding their teams in ways, and there's some leadership aspects to that as well.
Totally. Yeah, captain's great. And that's very different than coach. Very different than coach.
Yeah, your best team captain may not be the best coach, and the best coach may not be the best team captain.
Totally. I'm getting the feeling, too, that the coach is probably the leader. Coach is probably the leader, really. And I'm sure they manage to some extent, or in theory. But they're really, like, painting the vision for here's where we got to go and here's what it looks like. Yeah, that's a good analogy. I like that. Cool. Thank you so much. This was fun.
Yeah, thanks, Asia.